Technology is forcing our cities to evolve. It is redefining the meaning of location and accessibility, it changes the way we work and move around, and forces us to reconsider many of our basic assumptions. How should cities respond? What can be done to increase opportunity and tackle inequality? What is the connection between commuting, remote work, and overall prosperity? What should we make of all the trendy ideas that are currently being proposed, and what's so good about cities anyway? To discuss all this and more, I invited Alain Berthaud for a live chat a few days ago. Alain is one of the most influential voices on the topic of cities, urban labor markets, and urban transportation networks. He's the author of Order Without Design. He's a distinguished visiting scholar at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University and a senior fellow at New York University's Mellon Institute for Urban Management. Previously, Alain served as the principal urban planner at the World Bank and as a resident planner across the globe, from Bangkok and Sana'a in Yemen to Paris and New York, and even worked as a draftsman for Le Corbusier in India. For those not familiar, Le Corbusier is probably the most influential architect and urban planner of the 20th century. So what follows is a recording of my conversation with Alain. I hope you enjoyed. Thank you again for listening. Alain, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with a short and easy question. Why do cities exist?
Cities exist for people to get together. I think they very early realize that when a lot of people with different skills get together, they are more productive. They are able to invent new things. And I think that's the way cities came about. And strangely enough, we found now in the 21st century that the largest, even the extremely large cities of more than 10 million people, in spite of all the problem it caused in terms of transport, pollution, the people who are in these cities are more productive than the one who are in smaller cities, which seems more livable.
So what are the biggest mistakes that urban planners made over the last 100 years or so?
I think they make the mistake to not to understand that cities are made of the quality of people who are in cities, but that if they design city in a different way, the city will be better. I think that they could impose the consumption of land and floor space on people in the name of some equilibrium or efficiency. And I think this has been the most terrible mistake. We're talking about Le Corbusier, the Plan Voisin of Paris, of Le Corbusier, is an example of that. Brasilia is an example of that. So that's extreme, of course, example.
So trying to impose a clear kind of rational physical structure on where people live and assuming that that'll make things better.
Yeah, in the name of some efficiency, you can always optimize a sewer system or even a transport system in a city, but always at the expense of something else. And the trade-off has to be made by the people themselves. And when I say people, household and firms who are in cities, they cannot be done by planners who do not have the information to do these type of things.
So we'll come back to some more specific planning, I think, initiatives and mistakes, but maybe we're still warming up. So from a theoretical perspective, what is your favorite city on Earth? And why?
For a long time, it was Hong Kong. I am not sure now Hong Kong as it is, but for one good reason too. It's a very international city. It was a place, I had my favorite bookstore in Hong Kong, and I could find a lot of books by Chinese authors that you could not find in China. So that was one of the reasons, plus the beauty of the site itself. I remember landing in the old Kai Tak Airport, when the plane was landing there, it was absolutely spectacular. The plane turning around skyscraper, and sometimes you saw a skyscraper, you had the feeling the skyscraper within 100 yards from the plane, which possibly it was.
So, back to policy. Extreme question. If we abolish zoning and land planning laws, what would New York City look like in 30 years?
I'm not advocating abolishing everything. I would like to abolish some sanitation or fire regulation are absolutely essential. Building codes are also absolutely essential. What I will abolish, certainly, is the regulation which regulate the consumption of floor space and land. For instance, floor ratio, maximum building height, minimum plot size, minimum apartment size, maximum densities, the densities of dwelling units. I will abolish all that. I don't think those are useful at all. And by the way, if you look at New York, for instance, there was a study, a very interesting study some years ago, which shows that the major addition to affordable housing in New York were buildings which were used illegally by people who were adjusting their consumption, the consumption they could afford to what they could. So for instance, by subdividing illegally individual houses in Queens, and you had four or five families living there. And in fact, it was the largest contribution to affordable housing.
There's a lot of, I'm sure there's a lot of criticisms of these views. Are there any examples of cities that are doing it well and achieve success?
Partially. Yes. For instance, say in Shenzhen, the absorption of villages, and the villages have a special status, and villages were allowed to develop land use regulation completely different from the city. And they also provide a large part of affordable housing in Shenzhen, which allowed the labor market to work. The same thing in Indonesia, there is this policy of Fong. That means that within a city, you have perimeters where the normal land use regulation do not apply. You can consume whatever you want. You have some rules, but you can consume what, you know, as little land and as little floor space as possible. You can build a shack if you want in cardboard or bamboo. And so you have this perimeter of tolerance, I would say, which cater for most of the people who are poor. But at the same time, the state subsidizes infrastructure. They ensure that people living there have a safe water supply, the garbage is removed, and they have also some basic health and school facilities, which are shared, by the way, by higher income people.
So before my next question, I just want to remind the audience, feel free to drop your own questions in the chat, wherever you are, if it's on YouTube, LinkedIn, Twitter, and I'll try to bring them up, or at least a couple of them, towards the end of the session. So Alain, I think maybe you're even best known for this idea that cities are labor markets, you know, that we often think of them as physical things, but actually, ultimately, they're there to facilitate the interaction of people and the creation of economic value. If cities are labor markets, what happens to cities when labor markets suddenly become remote, or that many of them can move to the cloud? And even if we don't have a clear answer, how should we even think about it?
Yes, certainly you could think that the world is a huge labor market and location is not important anymore. I think that this is a bit a reductionist of my definition of labor market. Labor market is not the ability to get a job. It's the ability to meet people and to change jobs. And I am not so sure yet, I may be wrong, but I am not so sure that the technology we are using, whether it's Zoom or Google Meet or whatever, allow us to this flexibility, the flexibility of random encounter with people. And during the pandemic, I participated in a number of seminars around the world, and then it was reduced to Zoom participation. And for me, it was very different. I did my talk, I listened to the talk of others. But for me, going to a seminar or a conference is to meet people I don't know yet and to have a coffee after, and suddenly people who have different ideas or even are different fields. And that's this random encounter, I think, or I learned economics that way. I didn't learn economics in a university eventually later, but by meeting people and say something that intrigued me, and I say, could you explain to me what it is? And then I realized that economics was absolutely essential to my profession.
Yeah, I know that you're not arguing against that position, that you're taking a wait and see approach. But for example, you and I met on the internet. And I think I agree with you that the old way of accumulating knowledge and collaborating doesn't transfer well or as well online. But there's other ways. We met because we produce content. You read my stuff. I read your stuff. We connected.
Yes.
Not because necessarily we agree.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not against technology. I think technology is fantastic. And I'm a big believer in it and even an investor in it. But I think that this face-to-face contact and the randomness, this is what is important at the end. Then you have a social life too. That if you move to a place which is, say, environmentally very pleasant, let's say I move somewhere in Montana. I like hiking very much, Montana. But then I think you need still a social life. You need people. Where do you meet them? What structure will what are the contacts? So I think that this presence, now I may be wrong, it seems though that the people who are running a big high-tech company are agreeing with me because they built fantastic headquarters in Silicon Valley recently. Why would they build this headquarters if it was not to attract people to come to the office? At Google office or Apple, you have daycare center, you have fantastic, very good restaurants, by the way. Google had fantastic restaurants in their premises. This is to attract people to the office and to promote these random encounters within the employees.
Yeah. No, I agree. The question is the Googleplex kind of archetype, if it's a reflection of where we will be in 10, 15 years, or if it's a reflection of where we were 15 years ago, that kind of the culmination of something that might be changing now.
Googleplex is in the suburbs, so they are trying to reconstruct inside the headquarters what exists in
New York City,
village.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that New York University do not need to do that because we have plenty of coffee shop and restaurant, mm-hmm. all sort of thing, and to meet people randomly.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's what's perplexing about Silicon Valley in general, that people, it's one of the prime examples of like why urban areas are so productive, but Silicon Valley is actually not really an urban area by any non-American definition. It's just a highway with a bunch of suburbs and corporate headquarters.
And that's why they try to reconstruct a city with the headquarters. Yes, yes.
I think, to me, the interesting question, Seem, I agree with you that it's clear that obviously physical interaction matters and will continue to matter for a long time, even for work or for a lot of work activities. So cities will stay there. The question is how they will change because of those marginal changes in how people work. Will they become more equal, less equal, more diverse, less diverse? All the tech people in the city and everybody else outside, or some other mix, or the opposite? I think these are seem to be like the big questions for the next 20 years. Any hunches on that front?
I am agnostic on that. For me, cities are confronted to shocks, external shocks, like the COVID, maybe the price of energy, change in technology, and those things. So we have to adapt to those shocks. And the adaptation is not done by urban planners. It's done by individuals and by firms. The firms are confronted to change, and then they try things and some fail. The advantage of having that done by people rather than urban planners is that some people, when they try to adapt, are wrong and they fail. But then other people will have the right solution, and then the other will copy the one who have the right solution. If an urban planner decides the city of tomorrow is this, and he's wrong, and he probably, or she is wrong, and probably he will be wrong, she will be wrong. Imagine the city radios of Corbusier or Buckminster Fuller.
Yeah.
This were completely wrong thing. And imagine that he was a dictator and had done it. It would be a disaster for humanity. So that's the advantage of being, let's say, a little less proactive, but then monitoring. You have to monitor very carefully all the signal, land prices, lengths of commuting trips, for instance. The lengths of commuting trips, very important, I think. And all sorts of things you have to monitor in real time and then adapt infrastructure. Because again, there is a top-down thing. You don't bring water to New York City just through market. You have to take a decision. There is a lot of capital in order to water to. You cannot design also a sewer system or a subway system just through participation. You have to follow, you have to use the way people distribute themselves and job distribute themselves to design your subway, but it's a top-down operation.
So I think there's obviously a tension between letting people, letting things emerge, and making sure that the infrastructure is there for them,
yeah,
both today and in the future. What are some specific things that cities can do to design but not design the environment in a way that kind of fosters a more organic evolution of things?
Take land prices and rents seriously. Cities don't, very often they attribute high land prices or high rents to speculation and greed. I think they should take those signals very seriously. It means that there is a disruption in the supply system. And usually it's not, again, a silver bullet. It's not one thing that you have to do, probably 10 things you have to do in order to improve the situation. The crisis of now of affordability in the most efficient city in the world is a serious problem. And it's entirely man-made, in my opinion, because, again, of this restriction of consumption, which are basically a lot of people who live in cities, when they are well installed in the city, they don't want change because they like the city as it is.
Yes.
And I believe that land use regulation are not solely the invention of urban planner. They reflect a desire to slow down change.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to deal with that. On the other hand, slowing down change means the decay of cities.
So on the one hand, so we should lax or remove zoning laws or at least specific usage in terms of how space is consumed so we can enable the city to constantly change. On the other hand, we should actually give maybe a little more power to the government to force local communities to allow that change rather than enable whoever lives there now to prevent anyone else from ever building anything else there.
That's right, yes.
Let's see. What else do we want to talk about? I think related to this, when I prepared this question and booked this time with you, I didn't think this would be such a controversial topic. But I see now that in the world, and particularly in Europe and the UK, the idea of 15-minute cities became a hot political issue. I know that it's associated with Paris and the mayor of Paris who wanted to make sure that every neighborhood is self-contained in terms of people being able to work and consume and socialize. And now it's coming to the UK and people seem very angry about it. What's wrong or what's not wrong with 15-minute cities?
If it's 15-minute cities, any means of transport, that means if I can go from one extremity of a metropolitan area to another in 15 minutes, I'm all for it, using maglev or whatever, I'm all for it. But the idea of the 15-minute city in Paris was just walking. They say you could use a bicycle, but the distance is established by walking 15 minutes. Now, this is an absurdity. It's a complete misunderstanding of how a city works. So in the case of Paris, by the way, if we are talking about commerce, food, daily needs, this is met because Paris municipality has a density, a high enough densities. So there are indeed many bakeries and restaurants within 15 minutes of any house within, again, the municipality of Paris. That will not be the same in the suburbs. Where the thing is particular, so it's match. So when Moreno talk about a big bang, there is no big bang. It's life as usual on that. Where he's completely wrong, of course, when he's talking about jobs within a 15-minute walk. If somebody moved to Paris and pay high rent to live in Paris and high food price to live in Paris, it is not to take any job which is there because there are jobs anywhere else. It is to select the job which is particularly interesting. Again, they moved to Paris because there are some very interesting people there, very interesting firm who are doing very specialized things that they enjoy doing or they like doing. And so everybody makes a trade-off between where they want to live, next to a lot of cafe, or on the contrary, next to a golf course or a tennis court or whatever, or a Chinese school, I don't know. And then the type of job they want to do. And they are ready to make this trade-off. And therefore, you find people who live in the center of Paris who are commuting to the suburbs more than 40 minutes. And this is this is the way labor market works. So there is no planner who can bring jobs within, no planner can bring a job within 15-minute walk from my house, job that I would like to take. I can't find a job within 15 minutes to walk on my house. Probably putting cans on the shelf of a supermarket, I will not be very good at it.
You can learn.
Yeah, I will learn, yeah. But I will not particularly enjoy it. And I don't think my boss would be very happy with me anyway.
Yeah. So if I summarize the argument, people pay a lot of money. They vote with their feet by coming into large cities, which are large labor markets, because they enable them to be more productive and to match to the tasks that they could perform that they enjoy and are good at. And if you force them to be in a smaller labor market within this bigger metro, you're basically damaging them.
That's right. Economically. By the way, Moreno didn't force anybody. And that was a bit. He says that he can design a city. You could have your job at 15 minutes. Where I think, so he's not a fascist or a conspirator. It's not that. He's incompetent. He doesn't know how a labor market works. And it's a little frightening to think that he has so many followers that do not understand to this day how he thinks that if people commute a long time, it's because of the design of the city. Now, in the case of Paris, by the way, Paris do not have zoning in their very strict land use regulation in Paris, but there is no zoning in the sense of separating, for instance, a bakery from a residential area.
It's much more mixed than American cities.
You have lawyers who have their office on the fifth floor of a residential area in a condominium. So that, by the way, in New York, probably if we remove some of the land use regulation, it will probably improve also the accessibility. You'll have more restaurants and more cafe than you have now. And maybe more pharmacy or something like that.
And also when people are working from home, it's weird that they're allowed to work from home. But for example, if they want to have a customer coming to their house, then like you said, that it's not allowed or technically.
That's right.
They can't put a sign on the door and says, hey, I'm a lawyer or I'm a designer.
Right. That's right. That's oddity of working at home. Yes.
Yeah, to me, I mean, when I look at Moreno's plan and the 15-minute city, I agree with you. We don't want to design things too hard that we lose the benefits of the metro itself. And also, it seems to be like too much of a literal reading of what work means or what even a labor market means. Because one of the things that I think remote work will do for most people is not that they will all move and live in Colorado or in the French Alps, but that they will have to go to the office less, maybe only spend 2 or 3 days.
And that's probably very positive.
And will want to work near home, maybe in some kind of satellite space or a cafe or a working space. So I see a future where it's possible to both benefit from being in the large labor pool and the large metro and to have some kind of 15-minute style lifestyle most of the time.
Don't forget that also if you have this large labor pool, you have also a quality of amenities like opera, exhibition, concert that you will not have in a small town. Again, is Moreno thinks that instead of going to the Opera Garnier in Paris, we should go to the local primary school and listen to a concert there. I think that's a big mistake.
What I see that is starting to happen in New York now, for example, I live in a town just on the edge of the city. So it's not officially part of the city.
Yes.
It's very walkable. I can jump on the train and be in the middle of Manhattan in 40 minutes. I don't go there every day. Maybe I go once a week to Manhattan, maybe every 2 weeks. But it's still good for me that it's there. I have my 15 minutes lifestyle, but I benefit from being in the metro. And if I have suddenly a meeting that I have to go to, or like you said, an opera, a musical, a sporting event, I'm still paying for them, even though I'm not.
Yes, I completely agree. And I live in exactly the same way in a suburb of in Bergen County in New Jersey. Yes, exactly.
So related to this, there's a good book, actually, quite recent by Professor Richard McGehee called Unequal Cities, and brings forth the argument that particularly in the U.S., a lot of suburbs around large cities basically don't contribute enough or exploit the cities that they're built around because they benefit from being part of those metros, but they don't pay taxes directly to the cities. They don't help support all sorts of social services. They don't pay for a lot of the infrastructure that the city sometimes expands all the way to them to allow them access. What's your view on this topic in terms of how we distribute resources between cities and suburbs?
First, it's not completely true. Living in Bergen County, I used to pay taxes on my income in New York to New York. I pay toll to go across the bridge, $16 I think that yes, it would be desirable, by the way, to have an entity which is correspond to the metropolitan area. It's a bit like
so a political entity that can tax and
political entity, yeah, and also to develop infrastructure, things like that. Like in Paris, Île-de-France, for instance, I think is a good example of the Grand Paris, depending on the. And so I think that would be desirable. Doesn't mean that you don't, certain things are probably better done at a smaller scale. So you could have a smaller, let's say, municipality or neighborhood thing, which is done. But to say that suburbs I think are parasite, I don't think it's true. They contribute. When I move to the city to teach or to meet people, I contribute to the life of the city by being there. But it's true that taxation in the suburb town are too small, and then you could have enclave where you have completely homogeneous high income, so you have a high property tax. But again, this is specific to the US, where property tax finance a lot of things that should be financed probably regionally or even nationally.
Yeah, I think
that it has nothing to do in a way with the structure of cities. It has to do with the way we deliver, we subdivide, let's say, fiscal responsibility.
I think that's the crux of it, that in New York, for example, let's say, so I'm not officially residing in New York City.
Yes.
I benefit from its existence. I access some of the amenities in the city. But at the same time, let's say a lot of service workers live in the city. They need all sorts of social programs in order to be able to live there. I'm not directly taxed in order to finance those programs because I'm not officially living in the same
city. When you are going to a restaurant in New York.
Right. When I consume them directly, then partly.
Yes. So you are, there are 1.5 million people. Well, before the COVID, 1.5 million people going to Manhattan every day. Those are paying a lot of taxes in Manhattan. I'm sure they buy a lot of things in Manhattan.
No, but my school, let's say that what I pay for schools, it goes only to the schools in my neighborhood and doesn't benefit the people who work in Manhattan, for example.
Yeah, but say the sales tax, I assume, are being used in New York for school.
So I see we have a bunch of questions on the floor from the floor here. Let me pick this one to start with. So from Kuzma. So what do you think about the role of real estate becoming financialized? I think both large real estate, but also just people's net worth and pension fund, retirement funds basically being tied to their house. How does that affect the current shortage of supply and rising prices for housing?
I don't think whoever owned the house doesn't matter so much. As soon as they don't have a monopoly and they don't act to suppress the supply of housing, I think that Ronald Coase theorem saying that if you have market, who owns it doesn't matter really. Eventually, you will have an efficient way. What I think is...
Yeah, but here there is no market because the residents prevent other people from building new housing. So
that's right, yes. Yeah. Exactly, yes. So that's... But how do you deal with that? I think that you have to reinforce property rights. If you have a neighborhood... And the zoning in a way frees the land the way it is. If you reinforce property rights, you will allow some people who want to sell to a developer. We build a three-floor townhouse instead of an individual house. This is a right. In a way, it's a right of a newcomer. The people were there, and we all have the same right. So in a way, when you zoning put a big emphasis on the right of the people who are already there against the people who like to come there, and I don't think it's right. So it's a question of equity in property right.
Yeah. And also, I'd say, of the community against the individual, because if I own a piece of land and I want to build a big building on it, my neighbors can prevent me from doing so.
That's
or even
right.
People 3 miles away can prevent me from
people
doing
so. You have seen the story of 200 Amsterdam Avenue, where I think that we have these things about we have gone overboard into protecting people from very small negative externalities at the expense of huge positive externalities, which would happen by having a much larger supply of land and floor space.
Another question from Caroline. Ooh, it's a long question. I'll try to summarize it. So coming back to the 15 minutes, cities are dependent on cars, which disconnect transport from the land domain. What would you advise in terms of regulations of transition to a city where walking as well as public transport, new mobility services are enabling people to access what they need in this? Basically, let me make it even simpler. When we think of transportation systems, what should we aspire to have and to invest in over the next 20 years?
I think we should precisely look at the real estate aspect of transportation, which means if I move to New York with my car and I go down Fifth Avenue with my car, I consume 80 square meter of land and I don't pay for it. Mm-hmm. And so if I don't pay for scarce resource, I misuse it. So I think that above a certain density, we should look at what different means of transportation consume in terms of real estate and try to price this real estate at the right price. And then you cannot have, by the way, a city without individual vehicles. You have freight. You have some people, if you are a doctor or some, there are people, nurses, who need to move in individual vehicle. If you have a plumber, you cannot take the subway or a bicycle to deliver your bathtub. And do not forget that our cities, especially when they are dense, require an enormous amount of Pillsbury craftsmen working in them, people delivering beer bottle or wine bottles to restaurants. And so we have to accommodate individual vehicles. So those are, but on the other hand, developing efficient transport and whatever transport is efficient. And again, in terms of, we are talking about densities, about we have to consider the use of real, the consumption of real estate. Who has the best system now? Before they used to charge for entering a certain zone, they are charging for the time you spend in the streets. You are in a garage, you don't pay for it. And depending, of course, at which hour. So they
charge the car, yeah, not the person. Yeah.
Yeah, they charge the car. Yeah, of course, yeah, the car. So that means if you have two or three colleagues, then it's reduced the price by three or four. And it could be, so that's the way we should look at it. And of course, in very dense cities, try to look at the most efficient way of transporting people, which is probably mixing heavy rail, like subway or suburban rail, with micro mobility within the same trip. Mm-hmm. And where very often the people who run the transport system, if they run the subway or the heavy rail, they consider micro mobility as a nuisance. Mm-hmm. Because they create congestion around the station or something like that. So in fact, on a trip, it will be probably the trip of the modern city would be to use several means of transportation from door to station and station to station, then station to door. We use two or three different means of transportation.
Yeah, and I think the advantage of micromobility also that it's much more dynamic than building a new road or building a new rail line, and the city can continue to adapt and change.
That's right. Yeah, and you have constant supply and demand, which is much more adjusted. Yeah. If I leave my university after discussing with students at 11 o'clock at night, I have only one bus every hour to go back home. That doesn't match supply and demand very well. A car or a Uber is more convenient at the time.
Yeah, and I think if I can extract like a broader and more general point from your answer, is that I think on the one hand, we subject ourselves to market forces and it's not always pleasant for us. And we also like to blame the market for many things, even though it's not always the market's fault. But on the other hand, we don't use markets enough to solve certain problems, for example, land use and transportation. Right. If we simply put a price on what the car is using in Fifth Avenue, yeah, whether it's parking, yeah, or driving,
yes,
the problem, yeah, might solve itself, or at least go a long, yeah, way towards that, because currently, yes, we're giving, yes, land away for free.
About 4 years ago, I have a Chinese colleague that I had invited to a seminar at NYU. And so I pick him up at his hotel and we walk through the street. He was absolutely amazed to see that in Manhattan, you have a lot of people who park free in the street, yeah, in Manhattan. He was probably a member of the Communist Party. He understood markets much more than the mayor of New York.
Yeah, cars and Americans are hard to separate. It's like, cars, yeah, are a class of their own. They have rights in themselves.
Yeah, but as soon as they pay for what they consume, I have no problem with cars.
Yeah, I agree. All right, final question. What are you most optimistic about? I think you've seen so much, you've been involved in so much all over the world. When you look at cities and buildings and labor markets, thinking 20 years ahead, what are you most optimistic about today? And what surprised you compared to maybe what you thought we would be doing in 2023?
I think technology allows us to understand city much better. When I started my career in the early 60s, we knew very little about cities. Even daily traffic, it was very expensive to have origin and destination surveys, and they were inaccurate. And now we have a technology which in real time tell us what is happening in the city. So if we understand the city better, we should be able to manage it better. I'm not saying plan it better. I think the people who live in the city are planning it. But adapting all the services, including transport, was, for instance, I learned from one of my colleagues recently that now you can learn about the consumption of water every 6 hours in any cities because the meters are monitored automatically. Mm-hmm. It gives you a lot of, for instance, to know how many offices are occupied. This gives you immediately what days of the week they are more occupied. And things mm-hmm. like that. Something which before would have required a lot of survey. It will take 3 or 4 years before you get the result. And by that time, it will be obsolete. So I think that technology in this sense of increasing our knowledge of how we act together is going to allow us to do this really adapted city where infrastructure and services are well adapted to their inhabitants.
Good. So we can be optimistic. Alain, thank you so much. This was a real treat. I hope we can do it again soon.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a lot of fun.